Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between what's going on within us and what's going on in our larger world, everything that affects us, our health, our well-being, our communities, and our society and planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk with different journalists, experts, advocates, authors, scientists, policymakers, poets, artists, and today we're talking to playwright Karen Malpede. Karen is the co-founder, resident playwright director at Theater 3 Collaborative, and also she is the author and director of 19 and counting plays, including a whole host of terrific ones, Us, Better People, The Beekeeper's Daughter, Prophecy, Another Life, as well as Extreme Weather, which we covered this winter on Connect the Dots, and you can go back into the archives and listen to that show, which is a show about the environment. We'll be talking more about that today. Karen Malpede is a McKnight's National Playwrights and NYFA, that must be New York Fine Arts, I hope, fellow, and she's taught dramatic literature, playwriting and writing at Smith College, New York University, and the CUNY Graduate Center's Continuing Education Program, and she's also currently on the theater faculty at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Today, we're going to be talking about the role of art and creative expression in both foreshadowing the kinds of shifts in our world and in public events that we're witnessing now, as well as in kind of coming to some kind of understanding and sort of commitment to act, you know, in the most constructive ways in response to them with Karen Malpede. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Karen. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Allison. It's nice to be here again. Thank you. I wanted to say one other thing, which is that I do teach environmental justice at John Jay, as well as theater and justice. And that we do have a robust environmental justice minor at John Jay.
Can you talk a bit, for readers who may not be familiar with environmental justice, what that means, what is meant by that?
Sure. The climate crisis affects everyone, but it affects everyone disproportionately. And disproportionately, indigenous people, poor people, people in the southern hemisphere who have done the least to contribute to the carbon glut in the world, are affected the most by the severity of storms, by pollution, and, you know, in all the health issues and all the ways we know that climate change is disrupting the lives of people. So environmental justice is a look at the environmental dilemma, but also focuses on justice issues for people who have traditionally been, you know, at the brunt, taking the brunt of the injustice.
So, you know, it's kind of when I began covering fracking 10 years ago, it was basically not, I was kind of shocked, having been in the establishment media, to find out that it wasn't really being covered except as a kind of McCoy Hatfield disagreement among neighbors. And you know, and other people minimized it who were not in those regions. They didn't understand what we've seen this week, that, you know, we had multiple fires and gas pipeline explosions and, you know, and potential nuclear, you know, worries and disasters and all kinds of contaminations resulting from what are now advancing climate crisis conditions. And so people didn't really connect the dots and understand how this could affect them. You know, it's the whole idea that, you know, there's certain places, certain regions, it's going on over there, we're going to bury the pig feces, you know, in the ground somewhere, and it will never come back up, which is happening
or
this week.
Spray it on your garden.
Yeah, it's kind of going to go away because it's in some other neighborhood. So then when people, you know, protest about any of this, it's like, oh, you just don't want it in your backyard. Well, neither does anyone. And so there's a, and maybe that opens up our first theme here, which is this kind of out of sight, out of mind, it's not happening to me or us yet, and therefore it's not a matter of serious concern. you know, I'm just kind of saying what people will tend to feel if they think that, you know, they're kind of protected or by their economic status.
I think this has changed. I mean, I think this has changed in the last 2 years, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Where
mm-hmm.
unless you're very, very rich, and if you're very, very rich, you're building bunkers in and buying land in New Zealand to survive the coming climate crisis that you know is going to happen, right? That's
right.
For the mega rich, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most of us are not among the mega rich, but I know, and I know that my students know that they, even though they're much younger than I am, can see the change in the weather and understand that the climate is not what it used to be, even living in New York City. And many of my students grew up elsewhere. Some of them in the islands, the Caribbean, or in Eastern Europe. And they lived on farms, and then they moved to the city at some point. So they understand it also. I think that this notion that it's happening to other people, of course, it's happening more intensely to other people right as we speak, not to New York City. But I think that's breaking down. I think the heat waves, the enormous amount of rain we've had this summer, the instability of the trees, the shifts in when the seasons come, if they come at all, all of this is now readily apparent. To you know, ordinary people, and all they need to do is connect the dots and in other words, have the rudimentary understanding of climate change and what it means, and then the dots get connected. And of course, the role of the media, and to a large extent the role of culture, has been to keep that information or that connecting of the dots away from people so that they think of weather, not climate. They think of other people, not themselves, and don't connect themselves with others. The role of a sustainable culture is to connect the dots and to bring us all together in what is a shared, as we say, existential crisis.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you do that? I mean, what is your, how are you doing that in your current work that you're developing? You know, what are, what do you regard as like, kind of the pathways for doing that?
Okay.
You know, in theater and plays, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I've always lived a life as an activist, a teacher, and a artist. So those are three ways that I'm try to be active in the world. And I've been an environmental activist since the 80s when the ecofeminist movement first arose in my lifetime. And at that time, we were saying corporate culture has to go. Corporate politics and corporate capitalism is the root of the problem. And of course, Big Green and even Bill McKibben weren't on that page then in the 80s. It took a while for them to catch up with what the women were actually saying and the indigenous people have always been saying. So it has occurred to me recently that two groups of people who are pledged to tell the truth are scientists and artists. And politicians are certainly not pledged to tell the truth. They're pledged to say whatever will get them elected, right? And sometimes that is the truth, and often it's not. But scientists and artists their work is truth-telling. And I also think that we have a very similar creative process, that science, although it's about fact, and art, although it's about fiction, are primarily about truth, and that our discovery process is very similar, which is we find a problem, And we bang our heads against it for a very long time. We get very lost in the process of trying to solve the issue, and then we have our aha moment, which can be in a dream or in the shower or often while you're walking in nature or just walking in a city park, and you get it, and you run back to the desk or you run back to the lab, and you've figured out the next step, which only leads you to the next problem, of course. And so that process gets repeated over and over and again. But it's a similar process. So we get each other. Scientists and artists understand. And when I look back over my career, I've written a number of plays about science from different perspectives, coming at it in different ways, and about scientists. And the new play, Other Than We, is a futuristic riff on both linguistics, the origins of language, and the possibility that Homo sapiens in an extreme situation might actually be able to engineer a post-Homo sapien species that would be, quote, other than we in these ways, more able to sustain itself in a very fragile ecosystem and with its head connected to its heart, so that thought and feeling proceed as one and cannot be separated as so often they are in Homo sapiens. So this is the plot of the new play. The big worry is that they would engineer some monstrosity that would lack language, would lack the capacity to think, because that's actually what has made Homo sapiens so powerful, our linguistic and our thought process. But that's the tension throughout the play. Are they going to be able to do this? And also. Will they be able to birth these creatures so that birth, the process of birth and nurture, and they're not separate. We know that the child is born, the human child, is born with its brain not fully developed. And that child becomes more empathic to the extent that that child is looked at by other human beings. So when we were hunters and gatherers, we were carried everywhere, and there was always an empathic adult looking into our eyes, carrying us, because babies who weren't carried in a hunter-gathering society died, right? That's when human empathy developed, and that also, along with language, is one of our great traits. The woman who's done the most work on hunter-gatherer societies, I'm looking for her book because I always bollocks her name, has posited that human empathy is something that can be lost. Just as it was developed, it can also go away.
Wow.
And this is, it's Mothers and Others, it's a wonderful book, actually, by Sarah Blaffer Hardry. Her last name is Hrdy. And it's called Mothers and Others. And it's about hunter-gatherer societies and the development of empathy. And at the very end of the book, as I say, she suggests that anything that evolved through evolution, like empathy, can also devolve. And this is the premise of the play, that human empathy is devolving. People are living in a highly surveilled dome where the remnants of society have taken shelter. And these two young women, one a neuroscientist, one an obstetrician gynecologist, join with a refugee who was a physician in Africa, who has lost his entire family, has been admitted to the dome as a janitor so that they can monitor the radiation content in his bones because he walked there. So the three of them engage in this daring experiment, and they have to escape the dome in order to give birth, and they take with them a Noam Chomsky-like public intellectual who's a linguist. Who's very skeptical of their project, but his granddaughter is one of the scientists, and they kidnap him because they want Opa, they call him, to be able to transmit something that's been lost. I mean, he's the repository of essentially Western Enlightenment thinking. And they hope that he'll be able to give some of that to the newbies, they're called, these new creations. Whether or not it all works is the story of the play. The other story of the play, which is very close to, I think, many people, is the heroism it takes to birth a child and nurse a child and raise a child in this world. And, of course, that's becoming more contested. Should we even have children? How many children, if we do decide to have children? But anybody who has ever given birth and had the chance to nurture a child knows how charged that is, you know, that the minute you have a child, your life changes in a way that you never suspected, which is you're now connected to someone else forever, and that person may be in danger. And your job is to protect that person even though you may not be able to, right? And this is the experience of all parents through time, but of course it's becoming much more charged. And not just biological parents, but caretakers, people who take on the role, however they take it on. So that's something that everyone can understand, but it's set in this wild futuristic plot.
I'm really fascinated to hear this, and I can't wait to see the play. You know, it sounds fantastic, and the themes that you're developing are so rich and so core and important to now. But, you know, I just have to pause and just ask a few questions for further conversation about an exploration about this, because the theme is birthing and nurturing and empathy. They're important on so many levels. I mean, both at the core of who we are and how we got here and how we have, survived and how we've lived and what's been significant over humankind's, you know, time on Earth and everything. But also, the question, like right now, we happen to be, you know, having this conversation during, the several-week period of Senate hearings for a lifelong nomination to the Supreme Court.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Of Brett Kavanaugh. And so the whole theme of, who decides who has children, what the motivations are to decide, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the peril that those children now face, and the extent to which parents making those, or you know, mothers or the government, whoever is trying to make those decisions now, has to factor in this, the tremendous vulnerability and danger that comes from the climate crisis, and how conscious are people of this? How well are we, in kind of resonance with the true situation in making those choices?
No, I just read. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I just read a long article about Leslie Moonves. Not about Brett Kavanaugh, who I'm totally opposed to, but Leslie Moonves, who is the head of CBS, right? And
that's
it was
right.
written by a woman who worked, had a big contract at CBS, and was getting shows on the air about with strong women characters. And when he became head of CBS, he kept her on contract for 7 years, but he never produced another show of hers. He kept her muzzled for 7 years until finally she walked, and he never sexually assaulted her. He did. She knows people who he sexually assaulted, but he never did that to her. He simply censored her. And when she left, her agent said to him, what should I tell her? And he said, tell her to go F herself. He used the word though. And this, I mean, this has been my experience with powerful men who censor your work. I mean, literally censor your work. So you're always doing this cutting-edge work. If you do it in the theater, I mean, we will do this play at La Mama, which was founded by a woman, a black woman, Ellen Stewart, is run by Mia Yu, her granddaughter. So the theater is in the control of a woman. And that's where we'll do this play. And, you know, La Mama is a renowned institution, but it's also a marginalized one. Performances there only run for 3 weeks in a 99-seat venue, right? So this is, you know, this is already a kind of economic censorship, even though La Mama itself produces cutting-edge work from around the world, right? So just a segue from Brett Kavanaugh, who, if he is confirmed, will be a total disaster on so many levels, environmental, women's health, everybody's health, constitutional, you know, one doesn't even, it boggles the mind that this person could even be, you know, considered. He's an apparatchik, he's been groomed for this post. He is now being accused of a sexual assault in high school, and Dianne Feinstein has turned over that letter to the FBI. But it's not surprising that these men, these powerful men with their rigid mindset, abuse women on the side. You know, they have to do something with their erotic energy, and their erotic energy is so distorted that they become, you know, closet abusers. So,
you know, this goes right to the heart as well of the theme that your play explores, which is the devolution of empathy. Obviously, you know, the people we're talking about, you know, have a very,
they lost it somewhere, yes. Right.
You know, I remember years ago, you know, for many years in all of this, people would be saying, well, what do they think is going to happen to their grandchildren? Don't they love their grandchildren? And I remember hearing, I think it was either John Perkins or perhaps it was Bill McKibben at some event saying, forget about their grandchildren. Forget about trying to kind of awaken them to what might happen to their grandchildren if some of these horrible negative trajectories that we're seeing continue to proceed. You know, they don't care. And so it's like, you know, somewhere along the way, and this is what makes your play so central, you know, we have to, you know, we're all caught up under the control of, you know, these drivers with these power urges that have dwarfed and completely eradicated the capacity for ordinary empathy. And you know, what your play is, you know, kind of developing is the concept that we need to look at that for what it is. It's not just purely, it manifests politically, but it's a real failure of the human spirit, albeit, you know, sometimes religious motivations are dragged into the middle of it. You know, and we have to, how do we rebirth that? You know, how do we, who still have some empathy, nurture that in oneself and others?
Yeah. Well, this is the role of culture, right? I mean, we know that people who read fiction are more empathic than people who don't. At the same time, we also know that very few people in this country ever read a book after they get out of school. And as a teacher, I can tell you they seldom read books in school, but or often don't. But when I teach environmental justice, more and more I have an artistic component in the class, and I allow students, instead of writing a research paper, to do an artistic project. So they can write a play, do a video, write poems, do a painting, and they do all of these things. Not all of them. Some of them are scholars and they write papers. But others take advantage of the artistic project to put their own feelings into a form, right, that can be validated by their professor and the people in their class, so that it's not only what they learned in class, but it's also how they feel about what they learned in class that is validated, right? And this is, you know, this mind-body split, this binary, you know, nonsense has to go. But so does the devaluation of women who give birth, right? Giving birth is a heroic act. Heroism is defined culturally in Shakespeare, et cetera, as, you know, fighting somebody to the death for your ideals, right? And the body and the stage is littered with bodies, and the hero is either dead or alive, but he's valorized, it's usually a he, right, for doing this. And that's our definition of heroism. But a woman who puts her life on the line every time she gives birth, even Serena Williams, with all her money and all her fame, almost died in childbirth. Why? Because she was a black woman who wasn't listened to, and when she said, I'm in this horrible pain, they ignored her, right? And the blood clots, persisted, and she almost died. Women risk their lives every time they give birth, and this is a heroic act, and this has to be valorized. Likewise, caretakers, people who step in to help the woman, if she has any help, and so often she doesn't have any help, right? She's got to birth and nurture by herself, even in the middle of a war, which has been the truth of so many women's lives. But people who do take on the nurturing role are likewise heroes, because their nurturing ability helps that child develop its full empathic potential. And if children are not nurtured at all, they die. They die in Romanian orphanages because they're plunked in cribs and nobody touches them, right? And then they just die. But if children are nurtured badly, penalized, punitively, raised, they grow up without empathy for others, often.
So many people, I believe, in this country are, have been abused in their families. The values that we see are very punitive. And these punitive values that are expressed by the right wing, for example, resonate with a lot of people who probably themselves were abused and have internalized these. And so these kinds of values where, they're just, making harsh judgments about people. And so that is actually what you're touching on here to me is the psychosocial substrata of, what's going on in our culture, in our country, where people have, through these kinds of experience, empathy has died. A reliance upon a harsh authority resonates, therefore, with the abuse patterns that people have internalized. And, so what we're describing and fighting as a political battle, is actually, a kind of systemic social breakdown of certain segments of our society under this kind of rule. And it's kind of like the harshness of all of this. What does that do? And how can it be managed by those of us who still have residual empathy or who are carrying empathy, to face up to this, harsh cruelty, wrongdoing, incredibly adverse activities driven by greed that are going to have horrible impacts in the short and long term? How do we
We know, and I would say most people in the world have been traumatized, some much more severely than others, people who live in Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan, and go down the list, often by U.S. weaponry. But we also know that people who have been badly traumatized often become great healers. They don't always, they can become great criminals too, but often people who have been wounded most severely become healers. And we also know that that's because somewhere, sometime, somebody showed them kindness that mattered to them. And so it matters what you do with other people, right? You don't know when you show someone kindness, when you go out of your way to help someone, the effect, the lasting effect it will have on them. You know, James Baldwin, who I also teach, his father was a preacher who preached that all white people were devils, and Baldwin himself had no reason not to believe that because he grew up in Harlem. At the age of 10, he was beaten up by New York City police officers who found him on his way to the library at 42nd Street and said, you shouldn't be here, and they beat him up, a 10-year-old boy, right? He was going to public school in New York City, and a teacher, a white woman teacher, saw his brilliance as a little child, and she went to the house and she asked if she could take him to the theater, and she did take him to the theater against his father's wishes. He also met a Jewish student in school who became his friend, brought him home. His father was furious, but it was the New York City public school system and the kindness that he found there and the recognition of his great gifts that made Baldwin one of the greatest, most profound writers about race that we've ever produced in this country, and you know, a very, very great writer. So you don't know, you know, what effect you're going to have on anyone when you go out of your way to show them kindness, but it could be an amazing, life-changing effect, you know.
So, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, in the Jewish folk tradition, it's like, you know, the Baal Shem Tov, you know, being like a secret saint. It's not necessarily a permanent condition,
right,
where, you know, it becomes an ego identity and everyone else has to worship that person, you know, and then they're, you know, kind of held up as a model in a hierarchy, but it's actually just those small acts of secret saintliness.
And it may be the Baal Shem Tov, I don't know, but there's another Jewish tradition that 37 righteous people keep the world on course, and we don't know who they are. We don't know who they are, but there have to be 37 of them at any given time. Of course, the population was smaller then, but, you know, but yeah.
I was thinking,
yeah,
that's a lot of heavy lifting right now, yeah.
Right. Right. I mean, we can all
more
see that
needed,
the balance.
Yeah, more needed. So, you know, one of your themes, as we're discussing, is also, you know, the kind of the everyday, again, the same theme, but the unsung everyday heroism of women, you know, who are, you know, at risk to be denigrated and have been denigrated, you know, through these patriarchal control systems of various kinds, and yet who have to kind of keep on for the sake of their children. Do you, in your observation, which I realize is limited among your students, but, you know, but you do talk to different people, I mean, like I mentioned to somebody that I know that, you know, some of my nieces, my family relatives, although very maternal, caring, nurturing kinds of young women, are really from that very feeling state, quite reluctant and don't really feel a sense of security and confidence in bringing children into our world at the present time. And then, you know, when I mentioned this to somebody, to a friend, she was like, well, other people don't feel that way. I don't know what you're talking about, kind of thing. You know, what do you observe in that regard? Because I know for myself personally, going down the street in New York, when I see, you know, like a little infant or a toddler in a stroller, you know, there's part of me that is just, or on the subway when sees a lot of babies and everything, and there's always a feeling of, oh, this new, beautiful young soul, hello, you know. And then there's also the feeling of, you know, oy vey. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
the more
that women are conscious, and again, the more that women are educated. Two things: there are too many people on the planet. We cannot keep, you know, 9 billion, 10 billion, 12 billion. This is not a sustainable course. We have to reduce the population. The question is, how do we reduce the population? And the UN has embraced what is a feminist position, which is the way you manage population is you educate and empower women. Women who are educated, women who have jobs, who have a potential to work, do not have 7 to 12 children, right? They have one child or two children, three max, you know. And this would reduce the population in a generation or two, right? So it's not a, I mean, many sort of sensitive, educated women are saying, I shouldn't have a child, I don't want a child, the world is too horrible. And that's a legitimate position. I'm against policing anybody's reproductive capacity
sure.
in any way, right? But women who are empowered make decisions for the good of themselves and their families. Women who are subject and their only worth is how many children, you know, pioneer women used to have 13, 24 children until they died, you know, eventually they died in childbirth, right? There was no way not to have a child every year, right? Women who are still in that situation in other parts of the world where they're only valued for the number of children and particularly the number of sons they can produce, and they often don't even feed themselves until, you know, all the men have eaten, so they also are undernourished and they're still giving birth. These are women who are enslaved. So empowering women to make their own reproductive decisions in every way is also the solution to the population crisis. So I don't, you know, my daughter's pregnant with her second child. Her first child is gorgeously a dream. We talked about it. She was very uncertain whether or not she should have a second child. Ultimately, she decided she wanted a family. She wanted a sibling for her first child. But that's it, two children. And if she wants another child, she will adopt. That's her position. So she's sort of at the, you know, at the extreme of making conscious choice. Other women in her position will say, I won't bring a child into this terrible world. But I think, you know, in a way, when you say that, which is perfectly understandable, you're also saying there is no hope for this terrible world. Whereas, you know, children, as you said, do provide hope. Somebody's got to carry on when we don't live forever, right? So,
what do you look to as the sources of hope for people in this time? You know, who are kind of, you know, what do you regard as, you know?
Yeah, I'm really not interested in hope. I find hope a kind of vacuous concept.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you find hope? You know, I'm interested in acting without hope. Because it's the right thing to do. And, you know, I just had this very funny experience because for years I've shopped at the Park Slope Food Co-op and I've used their plastic bags. And in the last, like, 3 years, every time I rip a plastic bag off of the you know, thing that they're available, they're free to put your vegetables in, I felt like a criminal. And finally, I bought reusable cloth bags. And now I feel this tremendous sense of liberation when I go to the co-op and I don't have to use any more disgusting plastic. Even though I was reusing my bags, washing them, the plastic bags, still every time I went I would have to take one new one at least, right? Now I don't have to take any new ones. And I feel so much better. And this is something I try to relay to my students is what are the changes in your own life you can make, the small changes. They can't bring any straws into my class unless medically it's necessary for them to have a plastic straw, right? Then, of course, they can bring a plastic straw, and I haven't yet encountered that, but obviously, you know, right? The straw wars are totally manufactured. It's ridiculous. But what are the small changes you can make? They can't bring plastic containers. They have to bring reusable containers into my class if they're going to drink water or whatever they're going to drink. How does this make you feel to eat less meat, to whatever you do? You know, does it make you feel better? Does it make you feel more empowered? And if that is true for you, then you know both that people are capable of change and that it feels good, right? And that's what I'm working on, right? That's what I'm working on because we can't ask other people to change unless we can actually change, and none of us are perfect, right? We all have our sins,
right?
Which are fine, right? We all have our environmental, you know, crises. I'm working on my building because it's infested with roaches. We have no roaches in our apartment. We compost all of our food. Other people, you know, throw their food down the food chute, their food waste, and wonder why there are roaches in the apartment.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm working with the board at a glacial level to get them to switch from an exterminator who uses Syngenta products, which are known to be toxic, even though they're approved by the FDA, right? And we don't let them in our apartment because we have dogs, to one of the several green exterminators in the city. It's easy to find them. But this is a slow process of education of a lot of people in a co-op building, most of whom, get the Wall Street Journal. I mean, not all of them, but some do. I mean, are not interested in these issues. And yet, when you bring it up, when you explain it to them carefully, the board has at least come around to my way of thinking about the pest problem. So that's what I'm interested in. Personal change, which leads to social change, and hope seems to me to be beside the point. You can still change even if you feel terrible. You can still change even if you feel wonderful. Hope is as Emily Dickens said, a thing with feathers, and it can fly away. So if you rely on hope, you're stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I've been using glass straws, and I carry one with me in my purse, for a number of years, and I give them to people as birthday gifts. I mean, if I'm going to be giving someone a gift, I'm probably going to be giving them glass straws. I'm totally with you on that. But, it's just since we're talking about this, for many years, because I've been involved a lot in the sort of social policy end, we can't eat healthy food if we don't have the right regulations to protect the healthy food supply. That's been a big message of my work and my participation in the food co-op and all of that in that movement. Mm-hmm. So we can make the healthy choice if we've created the context that allows us to make it, if we have the economic privilege to make it. If we can't, it's going to be much harder. I know, there's food justice issues. People can't afford to make the healthy choice. Then they're unhealthy. Then they're blamed for it. So all of these things, kind of have two different handles, where you make. But I feel I usually am always counseling toward the policy change end so that more people can have that opportunity. And, of course, with the decline in caring, our society is going the opposite way. It's devolving the healthy choices for the most part. And at a rapid clip under the current administration. The thing about the individual choices, as you mentioned, is that when you start thinking about one, eating organic and humanely raised foods for, 25 years or whatever, then you start thinking about the next one and the next one. And contemplating the ways that we all, as good and kind people, participate in systems that are adverse and that are not universally kind and stuff like that. So we can espouse kindness on a, direct interactional level, and sometimes not even so well, and work on that. But also to look at, how it all extends out from
The personal is political, right? So the personal choice, the personal is political. So the personal choice is not the end game of anything.
Right.
The personal choice is simply a way to understand that choice is possible. If choice is possible for me, it's also possible for everyone else. I'm no different than anyone else. I may be more or less privileged in various ways, but there are still, there's always, and theater teaches this, this is what tragedy is, there's always a choice. You may have two terrible choices, but you have a choice, right? There's never not a choice. And it's in the choice that you make that you become the person that you are. And if self-realization, self-actualization means anything, it is all, it means what kind of choices do I make? And that's the simplest thing. Do I walk or take the bus or drive the car What kind of book do I buy? What do I buy in the store, and why? You know, and so the more that we're aware of our own choices, the more that we're aware of other people's choices and why they're making those choices, and we can support the people whose choices seem to be moral and ecologically ethical, and we can confront the people like Brett Kavanaugh whose choices seem to be made for many other reasons, like power and personal aggrandizement.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and yes, exactly. And I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing. Just going to that particular situation. You know, as we're recording this show and as the show will air, you know, we may not know. In fact, it's unlikely in that time frame that we will know what the outcome of that hearing and nomination process is. I mean, right now it's slated to kind of go rushing forward, but it's hit the stall point, as you mentioned, from Senator Dianne Feinstein's providing this letter to the FBI. And there have been other things that other people have done to show that his presentation of his record does not correspond with his actual actions, and that there's hypocrisy and even perjury and lying involved and that kind of thing. So, you know, even though there is the a Republican majority that, you know, is close to electing him, one of the things about activism that we know is we don't win every time, but the more that we stir things up, there's a possibility for delay, there's a possibility for other options to surface and other things to happen.
So, you know,
we're kind of living in the unknown, and, you know, we're taught to kind of have in this society, you know, like, who won, who lost? Okay, well, they didn't win, and, you know, this kind of quick validation, and, oh, there's no point fighting for that because we always lose kind of thing. But we don't always lose, actually, even though we're not as fully empowered as all of these greedy folks with their money.
Right.
Actually, we can create disturbance. We can intervene in various ways, and it's extremely important that we do it. So it'll be, you know, kind of interesting to see what the outcome of all.
I don't know what the outcome is with Kavanaugh. I hope to God there are a few people of conscience to join the other people of conscience to vote no. This is a nominee of a president who's going to be either impeached or go crazy or thrown under the bus by his own party. And the only thing they want from him is this Supreme Court nomination and the tax cuts, right? That's all they need him for. And it's completely, you know, hypocritical and ghastly and dastardly that they would confirm this guy at this moment when the presidency is falling apart and even they can see that in order to, you know, take control over women's lives, the environment, to further empower corporations. I mean, it's just ghastly. So yes, we have to intervene in every way we can, and hope to stall it because you know it's I mean that well yeah yeah it's a nightmare. That's what I say. We have to act without hope. We don't know the outcome, but we still have to act.
That's exactly right. I mean, and there are these upsurges. So, you know, there's a campaign called Be a Hero that is saying to Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who ostensibly is pro-choice but for reasons unknown, casts her vote along with the Republicans, you know, is saying, you know, if you do this, there will be repercussions. Now, she may not care. She may have been paid off to a degree that she can go, you know, retire to Fiji or something, and, you know, our words will fall on deaf ears, but it does constitute a warning to others that people will unite, contribute small amounts, and, you know, and there'll be repercussions rather than we just kind of throw our hands up in the air and say,
well, you know, when Roosevelt took office on the wings of, I mean, there was a huge labor movement in this country when he took office, a progressive labor movement, and he He inherited a very conservative Supreme Court, which would not have passed any of the New Deal regulations that he was putting in place, any of the things he was doing to help people literally eat and work during the Depression. And he just made the Supreme Court larger, and he appointed a whole bunch of, you know, his liberal judges to the Supreme Court. So it's not impossible that the Supreme Court could be reconfigured even if Kavanaugh gets elected. Even if he gets confirmed by a completely corrupt
mm-hmm.
Congress, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not
mm-hmm.
impossible if we take back, you know, in the midterm and then elect a progressive Democrat in 2020, that the Supreme Court could also be reconfigured. It's happened before. So it happened because there was a grassroots movement who had Roosevelt's back and was pushing Roosevelt forward with his progressive agenda.
So we are that movement, and we have to, you know, persist
yeah.
with that, keep
yeah.
pushing,
I mean, it's on,
invite
it's
others
impossible.
To participate, educate others. You know,
yeah, it's
all
impossible
of the above.
To think. It's impossible to think that American democracy will survive with a court that will be constituted as it is constituted. You've got Clarence Thomas, a known, you know, sexual abuser. You've got this raft of disgusting people on the Supreme Court. And if you add Kavanaugh to it, it's impossible to think that democracy can survive unless the Supreme Court is somehow reconfigured. So
yeah, well, that's even, you know, a lot of damage could be done in the interval, and let's hope we, you know, build mm-hmm. the movement very rapidly and kind of arrive there. Now, you know, I've been talking today with you, Karen Malpede, playwright, director, activist, professor of environmentalism, theater, and environmental justice at John Jay College in New York, and tell our listeners how they can read your new work and stay in touch and, you know, catch up on
yeah.
your older work
yeah.
and kind of, you know,
yeah.
Stay in touch with your thought and your creativity.
So a book of my most recent four plays that have been produced is published called Plays in Time, and it's four plays. They're all eco-peace plays. They deal with 9/11. They deal with rape and war. They deal with the ecological crisis, but they're all plays, so they're all funny and moving, I hope. I've been told both are true, and beautiful. I've also been told it's available on Amazon. The book's available on Amazon, where it has a raft of 5-star reviews you can read by people who have taught the plays, seen the plays, read the plays. So that's like the best way to catch up with my work. And then please join the mailing list. Send us an email at infotheater3collaborative.org, and we'll put you on our mailing list for notice of new work. My play about Yemen, called Dinner During Yemen, which is a very short play that was done in June, is about to be published on the Kenyon Review online, so it'll be free. It can be taught. There are three plays about Yemen and an intro I wrote to this, explaining the situation in Yemen as well as I could, and the U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen. So those plays can be taught, they can be read, they can be circulated. The book, likewise, can be taught, can be read, can be circulated. So, and then next year, not this season, unfortunately, I hope the two new plays will be on stage, one at La Mama and one at a theater to be announced.
Great. Well, that's terrific. Well, I'm going to look forward to the next performance as well, hopefully to come to that, too, as other New
yes,
Yorkers
please.
Can. And we'll,
I'll never forgive
we'll,
you.
I know. That's yeah. just incredible.
3 weeks is nothing. Three weeks
it.
Of a run, right? I've been working on this play now for 4 years. It took two years of doing nothing, and then you know, writing it, and then doing the rewrites and the initial workshop, which we just finished, which was great. I've been 4 years in this business of this one play, and it won't be done until next year. 3 weeks of a run is nothing. People can easily be
yeah.
booked for those 3 weeks, right? So this is
yep.
the kind of censorship
yeah.
we're up against, and it's economic censorship. Because
yes,
should this
I'm
play
very
be run?
running, very familiar with
should
that.
Should this play be running yep. now, and should it be running, you know, in an extended run? Yes, of course, you know, but we don't have the money. We're still fundraising. We have to get this, the booking at La Mama, which we've been promised, and then we only get 3 weeks. And that's because
yeah,
La Mama
I'm
has
very
to give
familiar with
bookings
this,
to
having,
other people, right? Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've experienced the same thing in the book publishing world because,
yeah.
you know, I wrote a book called Health at the Tipping Point, or, you know, I was a work in progress about 6 years ago about how, you know, these corporate industries are basically, you know, harming our health, contaminating the earth, harming our health, and driving us toward climate change. And everybody's like, well, that's too depressing. You know, and meanwhile, because I promote authors on this radio program and everything on this show, I get all of the current offerings from these different people. And, you know, so many people are like, the internet is hurting us. You know, there's so many books, it's kind of like this cheap sell, like, oh, you know, meanwhile, I'm on the internet constantly, but now we'll just do a book critiquing it, like as if that's our biggest problem. You know, or, you know, kind of how to be healthy, you know, when all hell is breaking loose or whatever, you know, except they leave off that part of it. So, you know, and I don't promote those kinds of books at all. I'm not interested in that portion of the conversation, but that is the portion that gets published and funded because it's like a simple distractions type of,
right.
you know, one idea
right.
solution.
Well, I mean, we...
So, yeah, I mean, we do need... you know, more nurturance, more understanding, more complexity of, you know, taking in the different things that are all interconnecting to create this situation. I love the whole theme of nurturance and, you know, in your upcoming work. So we'll look forward
yeah,
to
I mean,
that.
Yeah, that has in various ways been my theme forever. So all of the plays have various takes on bearing witness on and on empathy. They're drama. I mean, my intention as a dramatist is to dramatize the drama of empathy, not the drama of killing. It's very easy to kill someone, right? Too easy. And yet this has been, you know, conflict and drama has been defined either as violence or as this kind of bickering, the Edward Albee thing of we're all miserable and we bicker forever, right? And we just bicker, and women are really more miserable than anyone else, right? We're terrible people. We bicker. And that's the American sort of realism thing. It can be done with great skill. It can be done with less skill. I'm not talking about skill. Edward Albee was an incredibly skilled playwright, but his vision is not my vision. So my vision is to dramatize the drama of bearing witness and of empathy. And there's a tremendous amount to dramatize there, and that's what I've been doing in all of my plays since I started writing plays a very long time ago, because I was pretty young when I wrote my first.
This is great.
And a number
great
of these
stuff.
Plays are published. The most recent are the four plays in Plays in Time, but there are others that are published.
So people can start reading them in the current book, and then they can attend performances and go further. We're coming to the end of our time.
I wouldn't advise ordering from Amazon. I always advise ordering from your local bookstore and ordering from the University of Chicago Press or Northwestern University Press, which are two of my most recent publishers. But go to Amazon, because there you'll see all my books listed. You can read the reviews of the new one. You can get a sense, and then you can order it from your local bookseller and not from Amazon.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. You know, Amazon and Bezos, you know, is a capitalist monolith.
Yes.
And, you know, why should we be so lazy as to just go along with that and give them our money as they disenfranchise their workers, and now they're wanting to take over children's education. You know, they've taken over healthy foods. Not a good thing to participate in just because they made it two steps more convenient.
People miss going, knowing the shop owners who sell them the goods that they buy. So if you know your local bookstore, if you know your local shoemaker, if you know your local whatever, you know, owner of some small business, you also have a or the farmer's market, where I know the Hector who grows the greatest vegetables I've ever eaten, right? And I can check in with him every week. and see how he's doing and talk to him and, you know, yada da. This becomes a social. It enriches your life, right? If you order everything from Amazon or boxes of food arrive at your door, you never have that interaction with the producer, the grower, the owner, the person, you know, and your life is cut off. You know,
yes,
it's
and that's
so much
also
less,
a strip
less
down
risk.
Of empathy. Now we're yes. having to come to the end of our show here because we have a time deadline. But we obviously, I felt this before when we talked. We'll talk again when your next play is up, hopefully. And you know, coming to the area where people can see it, it's been a pleasure again, Karen Malpede. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots. Listeners, please do follow her work, her books, sign up for her email list so that you're informed about when to show up, and you can get it in your calendar in advance, which I'm promising to do for the next time. And
great.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us today on the show as well.
Well.